NPR, RNC, NFL, our culture is full of terms that include only three letters but signify just a whole lot more. And now let's add another to that list, GMO, genetically modified organism, something altered in a laboratory. GMO crops and foods are still fiercely debated in our society, and our guest this hour wades into that debate with her book. Caitlin Shetterly is the author of Modified, GMOs and the Threat to Our Food, Our Land, Our Future. Caitlin Shetterly has had her work published many times over in the likes of the New York Times Magazine, Elle, and Self, as well as online. She's the author of the best-selling Fault Lines, Stories of Divorce. Caitlin has also contributed to This American Life and other public radio shows. So, kindred spirit, Caitlin Shetterly, welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Thank you so much. It's wonderful to be here.
So you have covered, obviously, lots of other people's lives. Tell us about what happened to yours and your health.
Right. So in 2007, I got sick in the fall with something that was very perplexing. And it was autoimmune in nature. And it went on for about 4 years. I had rashes, headaches, a constant head cold, exhaustion, and arthralgias, or pain throughout my body that was, you know, arthritic. And for me, the hardest thing to take with that was that after I had my first son in the midst of all this, my body was so sore and I was so tired that it was hard for me to be the kind of mom I wanted to be. And it was hard for me even to button the little tiny buttons of his shirts and apply Band-Aids. And I felt sidelined a little bit as a mom. And we had been through the recession, and my husband had lost his job, and we didn't have tons of money, but we ended up spending thousands of dollars we really didn't have to try to find an answer. And I went to specialist after specialist. And eventually I saw an immunologist who said that he believed that since the advent of GMOs in the mid-90s, people were starting to get more and more of these kind of bucket illnesses, these illnesses that had no real clear answer, but that had all of these sort of similar patterns of a collection of symptoms. And so he thought I should go off GMO corn, which is the most ubiquitous GMO in our foodscape, and is genetically modified to contain a toxin, a pesticide called BT, and is also genetically modified to withstand the application of Roundup or glyphosate, the herbicide made by Monsanto. And it has other modifications. You can make hundreds of modifications within the genes of corn. Corn actually is very easy to modify. And so the question was whether or not it was the pesticide or the modifications themselves which might create unwanted or unknown proteins. He wasn't sure exactly, but he felt that he was seeing, as an allergist and an immunologist, this trend. So I went off GMO corn, and I felt better. And so the journey of my book was, I mean, when he first said this to me, I said, GM what? I didn't even know what a GMO really was.
So you didn't come in with us an axe to grind.
No, oh, God, no. It was 2011. I had really no idea. The only thing that I had was that about a year before that, my one-year-old son was having allergic symptoms. He was one, and he had terrible eczema, and he would have these sort of frequent and loose bowel movements, and he would cry sometimes to the point of passing out, like he was in pain, like his stomach hurt. And we did an elimination diet, and our pediatrician had just sort of randomly thrown in corn as like a last one to add to the list. And we did notice that when we put corn back in, it all came back. So we took corn out for him. But with him, it was crazy. That's when we realized that corn was kind of our Waldo. It was in everything. It was in vitamins. It was in cheese. It was in tea bags. It was inside paper lining paper cups, the wax. It was on the outside of fruit. It was in sneakers. It was, you know, in it was in food additives. It was in salt as a anti-caking agent. So we had already been through a little of this, but I had never, despite the fact that this seems like kind of duh now, even though I was breastfeeding, it hadn't occurred to me that I had to address myself quite the same way. And so my illness had gotten worse and worse, and then he said this to me, and I really had no idea what a GMO was. I understood it as sort of a word that had been thrown around, but or an acronym, I guess. And so the book is really a journey to figure out what a GMO is and explain it in very plain terms to the regular American, the regular parent, and to try to understand the question of whether GMOs are a good thing for our country, for our planet. And I would say that the revelation of the book is that the GMO is one thing, for sure, but the much more dire situation is the pesticides that are designed to go along with the GMO that we are saturating our earth with. And that is somehow left out of the discussion over and over again, and I don't believe that that's by mistake.
Interesting. Okay. So I want to come back to one particular point about your son, Marsden, and some of his symptoms. You had some real surreal moments, it sounds like, trying to get him not to cry.
Yeah, he would cry so much that he would pass out. He would hold his breath and pass out. And so we, as soon as we went on the elimination diet, that changed.
Really? But it sounds like before that you were doing things like, if you're happy and you know it, clap your hands, and trying to humor him out of a crying jag.
Yes, we were doing. We had been told by a doctor at the ER. We took him to the ER when it first happened because we thought, you know, his heart had stopped or something. They told us it was a syndrome called breath holding syndrome, and that you should just distract your child when it's happening. Our pediatrician said, well, often with behavioral issues with this, like this, there can be an underlying food allergy or sensitivity.
And that is, in fact, what your doctor said. We're going to come back and talk more with Caitlin Shetterly about what she found out from her doctor and from a lot of other people. You know, she set about writing the book Modified, GMOs and the Threat to Our Food, Our Land, Our Future. Back to talk more with Caitlin Shetterly, and take your phone calls and emails if you'd like to join us when we return to the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 10. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is Caitlin Shetterly. She's written a new book about her own experiences with food and the stuff she didn't want in food, as it turned out, both for herself and her son, via the doctor's analysis of GMO items being present in the food. Her book is called Modified, GMOs and the Threat to Our Food, Our Land, Our Future. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange as we talk about this always hot topic. 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. How many different doctors had you been to, Caitlin, by the time you got to Dr. Paris Mansman and he made the diagnosis?
Oh, God, I don't know. Quite a few. I'd seen pretty much everyone who would see me in the Portland metropolitan area, and then had gone on to Boston to Mass General to see doctors there.
Okay, so a whole bunch of people. It sounds like you had a bit of an attachment to corn, I mean, in your diet, historically.
Well, corn is ubiquitous in the American diet. It's in everything. So I think we all are eating it. In fact, I think it was Aaron Wolf's great documentary, King Corn, where there's that great scene where they analyze hair samples of people and they find that corn is in their hair samples because corn, whether or not you think you're even eating it, it's so ubiquitous. It's in beef. I mean, you can find corn protein in your hamburger patty. I think that corn, there's the line about the Mexican people who say, I am corn walking. I think that Americans are also corn walking.
Wow. So, and as you pointed out a few minutes ago, it's not just in our foods. You were saying that also in shoes and a number of other consumer products that are not anything you'd want to eat ever.
Corn's in everything, yeah. I mean, it's used as a wax on the outside of our fruits. It makes plastics that are, make water bottles, especially those ones that are partially biodegradable, supposedly. So you can buy a Coca-Cola full of high fructose corn syrup, and it can be in a bottle also made from corn. The plastic that is in your speaker, it can be plastics, chemicals, beauty products, shampoos, laundry detergents. Corn is pretty much a wonder seed. You can make pretty much anything out of it.
So when you were eliminating corn from your diet, was it just the edibles, not the other stuff as well?
pretty much just the edibles, yes. Mm-hmm. I mean, we, you know, any like when you put hot tea or coffee into a paper cup, you know, you might get some of that wax, so we tried to minimize that. Of course, that's hard to do when you're traveling. We tried to carry stainless steel cups with us, things like that. But, yes, we eventually were just trying mostly to eliminate any corn that would be consumed.
Sounds like it can get rather mind-boggling. I mean, how much stuff did you have to throw out of your cabinets and refrigerator and all that?
Well, we've, you know, it was mind-boggling. I mean, it was definitely the Waldo, and every time I would turn a corner, there it would be again. It would sort of be like, oh, gosh, corn alcohol is used to make this vanilla, or it's in baking powder. That was another thing that really surprised me, or that it's in table salt. And so, you know, now, for instance, I do a lot of cooking for my family, and I use cream of tartar and baking soda, a 2-to-1 ratio, and I actually like it so much better than baking powder. It works so much more nicely, and so there were happy endings to these twists and turns as well.
Well, and the major happy ending you were looking for was an improvement in physical well-being. And how soon after you changed diets for yourself and for Marsden did you notice changes for either of your health?
Yeah, so with my older son, it was almost immediate. As soon as we put him on an elimination diet, he was better. And then when we brought corn back in, it was sort of an immediate thing. Again, the eczema came back. He seemed to be crampy and uncomfortable. And with myself, it took a few weeks, but it was kind of miraculous. As soon as we got this very clean diet going, where we were making everything from scratch, and we changed our diet to completely local and homemade and organic, I felt better. Now, one of the points I make in the book, and the last chapter is called Invisible Monsters, and that's about how, you know, there are so many things that are invisible monsters to us these days. I think especially to the parent, I can't tell you how many times I've heard recently people telling to me they feel helpless, and I understand that feeling completely. I feel it too in so many ways about so many things in the world right now. And I don't know, and this is the journey of the book, and I'm really straight up about this in the book, is I take this journey. I went to the Great Plains and across our heartland, and then I hung out with beekeepers in Europe, and then I went to California and hung out with scientists. And I say in the book, I will never know. You know, the natural skeptic in me, the pain in the butt of me, is that I was always questioning this theory that I was given, that whether or not it was the GMO corn. Could it be the pesticides that they come with? Could it be that something else in my diet changed? I don't know. I do know that I was healed. It felt almost miraculous. What felt like I was in sort of a lifelong purgatory, I was released from. And now I feel great, and I have felt great for a few years now, and I haven't gone back. So, you know, the book is really a journey. It's a journey of questions, and I think questions that we all have.
The book is called Modified by Caitlin Shetterly, GMOs and the Threat to Our Food, Our Land, Our Future. You did get started with this by publishing an article in Elle in 2013, and I guess you learned then nobody is just plain meh about GMO.
Yeah, right. So there was a pretty swift and vituperative attack from Big Ag to my piece in Elle, and it really made me think. I mean, my piece seemed to make some proponents of GMOs actually angry, and also, something had scared some of the people whom I had interviewed for that piece. They now wanted to recant their statements. So I wondered what had happened and if there were things that I didn't really understand about the GMO debate or nuances that I had missed. And that's when I decided to just begin this incredible journey, as I said, across the Great Plains and our heartland into Europe and California. I wanted to try to look more deeply at this issue from a variety of angles, farmers, activists, scientists, doctors. And I did, I was ruthless with everybody. You know, I looked at the anti-GMO people and the pro-GMO people, and I held them all up to the same standard.
So given the history with the L article and I looked at some of the critical responses to those, they were harsh. When you asked us to visit people like GMO farmers, did you get some reactions from people who just said, nah, thanks, no?
Well, I'll answer that question in two parts. I ended up, the whole beginning part of the first section of my book, called Flyover Country, which takes place in Nebraska and Iowa. That part of the book, I hung out with a GMO farmer named Zach Honeycutt in Nebraska. And he's this young, handsome, John Deere-driving guy who grows GMO soy and corn and popcorn, which is not GMO, by the way. That's a different discussion. But I spent some time with him, and, you know, he had definitely read up on me. He had read the controversy, but he was open, and he was really warm, and he listened to me, and he told me his theories. What's really interesting about him is that when you get to the end of my book, he just recently decided to this year he didn't grow as many GMO crops. He decided to grow a few non-GMO, that he was starting to have questions himself about whether or not, A, the market wanted this, and B, that if there were this many people against it, was this really the best thing for him to keep growing?
Hmm. Interesting perspective there. Caitlin Chatterley interviewed that farmer and many other people in her book, Modified, GMOs and the Threat to Our Food, Our Land, Our Future. You can join this discussion on The Exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. Caitlin, I haven't told you so far. I don't know if you're aware that Jackson County, Oregon, where our studios and offices are based, is the only county in Oregon that's been allowed to vote to ban GMO crops, successfully has done so.
Yes, I remember all that in the news. And, of course, I'm wondering how the DARC Act is going to affect you.
Well, I don't know. There's been a lot of conjecture about that. DARC is the acronym for what? Deny Americans the Right to Know, which is obviously not its official name, but...
No, not its official name, but the name that the anti-GMO people use as an acronym for that act.
So give us a sense, beyond talking to individual farmers, what kinds of connections you were able to explore between where the money comes from and political power on this issue.
Yeah, so I talked to farmers, I talked to scientists, I talked to activists, I talked to scientists who were pro-GMO and those who were anti-GMO. I think one of the most exciting interviews that I did was actually with a guy who has been found. There was a great piece last fall in the New York Times by Eric Lipton that traced the money trail from Monsanto to this scientist, or at least the special perks trail. But his interview was very interesting. He said to me something that was very illuminating, which was that there's no government regulatory agency looking over, the GMO situation or handling it. For instance, the EPA registers GMO corn as an insecticide, not as a food. And when I asked him why that was, he just said, well, they don't have the staff. The USDA can't really manage the GMO crops, so the USDA will tell you they have plenty of teeth and plenty of staff and they can handle it. But he basically said that they don't have the staff and they can't do it. And this is something I've heard other people mention as well, and the FDA doesn't as well, and nor does the EPA. And Congresswoman Shelley Pingree, who is in my book as well, she said the same thing, that these regulatory silos, she called them, are getting more and more defunded, and there's no one to really examine these issues or manage them. And he just laughed and said to me, look, they'd have to back up two tractor trailer trucks of data to each of those agencies, and then they would have to have the staff to go through the data. So he was basically saying it's better if the industry just does their own tests and tells us if their own product is safe or not. So, you know, you have to pause and stop. I mean, you have to ask yourself. I mean, I think Eric Shivian, who is a professor at Harvard, said to me, well, how would the American people feel if the tobacco industry said, well, we're conducting our own tests on secondhand smoking? That's what's happening. The industry does their own tests, and then we then fall in line about whether or not it's safe. So we have to ask more questions, I think.
Well, the defunding of the regulatory agencies then would seem to be a deliberate act by Congress, specifically about GMOs, or just to make the agencies less toothsome than perhaps they were before.
Yeah, I don't really know the answer to that, why the defunding is happening. I think that, you know, there are lots of complicated reasons that I can't even begin to go into here. But I do know that as far as research goes into these topics, some scientists mentioned to me the research recession, they called it, and that there just isn't the funding unless you get the funding from biotech, mm-hmm. unless you get the funding from the industry. But the industry doesn't want you to do the tests that you want to do, perhaps, and they will go to great lengths to make it hard for you. Or if you find something that they don't like, they might try to squelch you or quiet you or buy your research from you.
One of the responses I saw to the article in Elle described the view of science of GMO food and its effects on humans as being settled, that there is no effect. I mean, the settled science thing really bounce off you hard?
Well, it's hard to say something is settled when the only research that's been done really has been done by industry. And even the National Academy of Sciences review that came out last spring, when Food and Water Watch looked under the hood with that, they found that most of the scientists who had been brought in to address and look at the science to do with GMOs, they were all in some way connected to industry. So this is a rigged system, to put it mildly. So I don't know that we can say any science is ever settled anyway. Scientific, you know, rigor depends on debate. The other thing about those attacks on me is that this past winter, when we were finishing the book and doing the fact-checking and legal reads, we discovered, actually, from the New York Times reporter Eric Lipton, who did the piece about Kevin Folta and Bruce Chassis, both of whom are scientists, whom Monsanto gave at least special perks or gave funding to their research institutions in exchange for promotion of their views. We found that in the FOIA, which is the Freedom of Information Act, emails that were released to the U.S. Right to Know campaign, Eric Lipton said that I was in those, and it appeared as though Monsanto had asked at least Kevin Folta and perhaps one of the other people who attacked me to attack me. So the plot thickens, you know. You start to wonder about this stuff when you see and hear these kinds of things about made me wonder, why am I such a danger to this company?
Caitlin Shetterly is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. Her book is Modified, GMOs and the Threat to Our Food, Our Land, Our Future. Here's a call from Connie in Eugene. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Yes, good morning. Fascinating. You've done a tremendous amount of research. I really would like to ask, it's a tangential to the GMO question, but it's something I wondered. I grew up in corn country in Illinois, and there was always a lot of talk about the danger and the deadliness of some form of rust or fungus that occurs on corn. And I've always wondered, especially with ground corn products or processed corn products, if they are containing this fungus or rust, and that people would be responding to that, you know, regardless of GMO or non-GMO. And I wondered if in your research you have encountered the possible dangerousness of this disease that corn gets.
Okay, thanks for the question, Connie. Appreciate it.
That's a great question, Connie. You know, I don't know much about the fungus, but I have heard of it myself. And I will tell you that at the end of my book, I asked some questions about that too, and about whether or not that could also be making people sick. So, or me sick. You know, what I list, because I went into this book asking questions, and when my editor bought it, I said to her, I'm not going to have a smoking gun. Some editors who interviewed me with the desire for me to write this book wanted me to come out with something that, you know, said, for sure GMOs are bad for this reason. And I said I wouldn't sign on for something like that. I didn't feel I would have integrity if I did that. It needed to be a journey to ask questions. And I think a lot of people have been surprised, A, about how ruthless I was with everybody. That's the word that I've heard over and over again, that I was as hard on the anti-GMO people as I was on the pro-GMO people in order to tell an honest story about this debate. But also that at the end of the book I talk about, okay, so what are the things that I eliminated when I eliminated corn from my diet and fungus does or mold does come up?
So were you able to get to the end of this? And I mean, I'm gathering from what you're saying that you got a couple of broken lines here where you can't quite make a firm connection between, your experience and a lot of other people's for that matter, and GMOs, positive or negative?
Well, no, I don't know if it's a broken line, no, per se. I do feel that GMOs are a real danger, and here's the biggest danger. I would say that the revelation of my book is that the GMO is one thing. You know, we are making products which contain genes that probably should not be there. Notice the word probably. And we are also making products that carry their own insecticide inside them. In every cell of it, there is an insecticide, and we are eating that. Pause that thought for a second. The pesticides are the real issue we need to be talking about.
All right. We'll come back and talk more about pesticides and GMOs. Caitlin Chatterley's book is Modified. We'll come back and talk more with her and take phone calls and emails from you when we return to the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 25. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest is Caitlin Chatterley, who has had her work published many times over, including her her best-selling book, Fault Lines, Stories of Divorce. She took a personal odyssey for herself and for her son as she noticed some ill health effects that doctors couldn't solve. And one doctor finally said, why don't you get GMO corn out of your diet? And what do you know? Things got better, drastically so. Her book is called Modified, GMOs and the Threat to Our Food, Our Land, Our Future, a personal investigation with a lot of different people with many different opinions about GMOs. You can join us on the exchange and share yours at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. We have focused a lot on corn, but you do point out, as other people have, the widespread nature of genetic modifications in other crops. How widespread within some of those crops?
How widespread are the crops themselves?
Well, yeah, like soybeans, for example, is a very high percentage of that is all GM now, isn't it?
Yes, exactly. Soybeans is, you know, upwards of 93% or more soy that's grown in this country is GMO. That may even be a conservative number, and corn is 90%. We have over 170 million acres of GMOs growing in this country right now. That's an incredible number. We have blanketed this country with these crops. Now, the most dangerous thing about that, from my point of view and my research, is that we need to change the conversation. The GMO debate is we keep talking about labeling, but the salient point is really this. We need to be talking about the incredible uptick in the use of pesticides since the advent of GMOs. And we need to talk about what this is doing not only to our own health, but also the health of the planet. And we aren't talking about this. As far as I'm concerned, this is our food and how we're growing our food is probably the most important issue we aren't talking about in this presidential debate. And the GMO and the pesticide are inextricably linked. And as many of you, I'm sure, know, the GMO is engineered to withstand the application of Roundup, which is the herbicide made by Monsanto. But as I discovered in my book, hanging out with Zach in the Midwest, is that these farmers use a whole cocktail of different pesticides. And we don't even have any regulatory agency studying what the synergistic effect is of these pesticides together. And many of them we know by themselves are endocrine disrupting. We are seeing incredible upticks as far as things like obesity, just children alone, obesity, learning disabilities, ADHD, autism, endocrine disrupted diseases, a 40% rise in new cancers in children, congenital birth defects, especially in boys, of their genitalia. So I think it's a pretty serious situation to talk about and we need to be talking about the pesticides and how they are linked to these GMO crops, which are blanketing our country.
You were just talking about Zach, the farmer in Nebraska, Zach Honeycutt. He apparently had already had some questions about GMOs himself by the time you met him. Is that true?
Not by the time I met him, but last winter he called me and told me that his own brother, they were on the Corn Growers Association, and they grow this GMO corn, and his own brother suddenly stopped being able to eat corn and most grains, and that they started to wonder about GMOs, and they were going to start growing some crops non-GMO.
So
that was a pretty amazing thing to find out, and I did write about that at the end of the book.
Mm-hmm. You did learn a lot, clearly, about Roundup and 2,4-D and atrazine, and how much, you mentioned 170, well, no, it's 107 million acres of GMOs. And you did say, though, that insecticide use is rising, is that right?
Yes, so that's what's so amazing about this, right? The GMO, the promise of the GMO was that we were going to actually use less pesticides, but that has not happened. And instead, we are using more pesticides than we ever have used before. And that was really the guiding thing for me in this book was Rachel Carson. As you probably know, her 1962 book, Silent Spring, was about the dangerous effects of not only the chemical pesticide DDT, but of many pesticides used in homes and on the sides of streets, in public parks, on school playgrounds, and on industrial crops across America. Anyway, so when Silent Spring was published, it became an immediate national bestseller. And her words just shocked people. They were like this glass of cold water thrown on their consciousness. And JFK was so influenced by the book that he appointed a committee to study Carson's conclusions. And then in the mid-70s, in her wake, after she died tragically of breast cancer, the modern environmental movement was begun. So the guiding question for me was, how did this happen? And yet, somehow, our production of chemicals has actually increased. We now have 85,000 chemicals circulating in the environment. To date, of those 85,000, only 200 have ever been tested by the EPA, and a mere 5 have ever been banned. And only those 85,000 chemicals equate to 4 billion tons of chemicals released into the environment every year, and 72 million tons of those are known carcinogens. So I guess that was, like, I kept thinking about that, and she was really with me, sitting on my shoulder the whole way through this book. And the question I had was, how is it that the way we are growing the food we need to feed our families, to feed our children, we need food in order to survive, how is it that we are doing this in a way that's actually making us and the planet sicker? And, you know, of course, I touch on climate change in the book and how our agriculture is affecting the climate. And then underneath that umbrella of Silent Spring, I talked a lot about pesticides. And one of the scientists I spoke to said, listen, if it's designed to kill stuff, of course it's not safe. You know, they can't tell you something that's designed to kill stuff is safe. And because of GMO proliferation, we are using more pesticides than ever before. And this was not the promise of the GMO.
All right, so more GMO and more pesticides all at the same time.
All at the same time, they're inextricably linked, and we are saturating our country with them. It's getting into our water. It's even going filtering down into our aquifers. We know this intuitively. Like, you cannot see those pictures of dead bees after the spraying for Zika in South Carolina and not know that when you kill, you've killed those bees, but there are all these other species that we probably also killed, species that are not as exciting to talk about as bees. And then that's going to affect the entire ecosystem, everything from birds to frogs. We are changing the landscape. We are modifying our environment. And the mother in me, the person who wants to hand down to my two little boys a planet that is safer and greener and cleaner, is outraged by this because this is not the promise that I think we were told.
And it's not just our human charges we're concerned about, as Rika and Grants Pass can relate to us. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Caitlin Shetterly.
Well, good morning.
Hi.
About 10 years ago, I realized my dogs, they've been getting skin infections, ear infections, having trouble healing. And I decided to go for more expensive dog food and get rid of that cheap corn-based stuff. And they got better immediately.
Really? It was that fast?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I've heard that so many times from so many people about their dogs.
Okay, so yeah, it's obviously animal food as well, but the ubiquity of corn just amazed me, though, when you talked about the shoes and everything else, though.
It can be, it's like the miracle plant. You can use it for anything.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, we need to really be thinking about this Monsanto Bayer deal, right? So now we have the largest agrochemical company that makes these GMO seeds, who also makes the pesticides for the seeds. Now they are bought out by Bayer that will make the medicines that we might need if we get sick from their products. This is a closed loop. And I think if there's anything that's quite obvious in this election is that people are feeling helpless and fed up and like they have no power anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And what does this mean for us if one enormous company controls all the food in the world and also controls how that food is grown?
Let's take another call. We have Archie and Talent on the line. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Caitlin Shetterly, the author of Modified.
Hi, thank you. I'm curious about the Roundup Ready weeds that are being pollinated by Roundup Ready plants and a cross-pollination process. So the weeds are becoming Roundup Ready, and now we have to spray and make stronger poisons to kill these weeds, which is getting on our vegetables. And we don't have any Roundup Ready people alive today, okay? That would be another genetic modification. So I really think a comment on Roundup Ready weeds and how that can be stopped. Should be addressed.
Okay, you've coined a great phrase there. There are no Roundup Ready people. Thanks for that, Archie.
Caitlin, yeah, that's funny.
Yeah.
Well, who knows? I mean, all the gene editing, the CRISPR editing that could be happening now, maybe we will have to become Roundup Ready ourselves. So, the super weeds is what I think he's talking about. And the weeds that have become impervious to the spraying of Roundup, they have evolved. Steve Hopp, who is a professor of environmental politics in Virginia, I think he said it best. The GMO only makes sense if you freeze evolution. And I say that in my book. I mean, the world, the plants and the bugs and everything are going to evolve. The issue for all of us, plants, bugs, humans, is that we may not be able to evolve at the speed at which we are creating these chemicals. So, but things will evolve.
Well, one of the things, to come back to Rachel Carson, you talked about the fact that she made a big difference. A lot of people listened to what she had to say, but it seems like people who come out with warnings now, sounding similar alarm bells, don't get the same level of respect, and maybe she didn't at first herself. But you relate the tale of Tyrone Hayes from UC Berkeley. We've had him on the program, too. He's gone through enormous, almost crucifixion for the scientific information he's put out about the effects of atrazine in the environment.
Yes, atrazine, the herbicide sprayed on GMO crops, again, often used in a cocktail with Roundup and everything else. His work is amazing, and he is a truth teller, and he is so bright, and I just loved writing about him. But these companies are even more powerful than they were. But do remember that when Rachel Carson, when Silent Spring came out, the industry vilified her. They attacked her as hysterical. They went out after her as a woman, which, by the way, when I was attacked in 2013 for my piece in Elle, I was also attacked. That was a fatal mistake that these companies made, actually. It was they attacked me and Elle magazine as not being up to the science because we were women. And that created a backlash against them.
Wow.
But, yeah, it was just that wasn't the way to go. But Rachel Carson was vilified. She was called a tree hugger. She had they said she had cultish nature tendencies. And they went after her hard. This was a woman, though, who was writing this book while she was dying of cancer. And she was in pain, and she was scared, and she would stay up all night writing. And she had to do this. She knew she had to get this book out before she died.
Some of the people you talked to, you mentioned you did try to talk to everybody who had a perspective on this, or at least a lot of people had perspective. Rick Goodman used to work for Monsanto. What was that rapport and conversation like, or set of conversations?
So Rick was a former Monsanto seed scientist, and Rick has amazing and exhaustive energy for the subject. And I talked to him a lot. Rick is very pro-GMO, and I write about the difference in our opinions and us pushing back at each other in various ways. And Rick was not pleased with me with the L piece. However, he did agree to meet me again, and I interviewed him further in Nebraska. And, you know, he provided a very important voice in the book, and I am extremely grateful to him for that.
You seem to be decrying the fact that we can't get this issue in the presidential campaign. Are you taking it up in local politics in Maine or with you don't have a Senate race this year, do you?
Yeah, no, you know, it's funny. I'm not an activist. I'm really a writer, and I wrote this as a story and a journey, and I think people will see me as an activist, and if I am, I'm an accidental one. But I do think our food is an extremely important issue in the presidential debates and how we're growing it and what we're doing to the planet. But I myself have my hands full with trying to write stories and parent my two little boys. And I never wrote this to be an activist. I wrote this to tell a story and to try to understand the debate.
Well, it is a fascinating story, and let's see if it does come up in the presidential debate in 5 days. Caitlin Shetterly is the author of Modified, GMOs and the Threat to Our Food, Our Land, Our Future. Caitlin, thanks for joining us today.
It was a blast. Thank you so much for having me.
All right, sure. Take care.